better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is April the 14th, 2014. That means today's date is 4-14-14. Yes, I'm one of those weird people that notice repeating patterns in numbers and associate numbers with other things at all times. It's just part of my quirky personality. Yes, if I see the numbers 270 or 3006 on the back of a license plate, I make that connection, etc. Anyway, today we are on a Monday glum day, Monday the beginning of the week, Monday. That means it is time for your feedback and me answering your questions, comments, concerns, suggestions, etc. When you send me an email at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, again, the email to reach me at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. In your subject line, put article for Jack, question for Jack, subject for Jack, comment for Jack. One word followed by the two words for Jack. It will go into a special filtering mechanism, and voila, it will end up in a certain folder in my Outlook, and I shall then doth pursue going through that folder to see if I can put your comment, question, etc. on the air. I don't get them all on the air because a couple hundred of those a day come in. I do try to at least look at them all and look for ones that are coming in about the same thing from lots of people. Before I get to those, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you by helping to make sure the show's here for you Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. Sponsor of the day, number one today, jmbullion.com. What is bullion? Is it stuff you boil in a pot to make chicken soup? No, bullion is in gold and silver bullion. Yes. You need this in your investment portfolio. Sorry, I'm feeling a little funky today. I'm tired. I'm trying to wake myself up. But you do need to have gold and silver, I believe, in your long-term asset strategy plan. I'm not one of these people that tell you the dollar is going to be worthless in 5 minutes. Liquidate all your assets and buy my silver now. That is what morons tell you because they want your money. What I'm telling you is 5 to 10% of your total net worth in precious metals is a very good strategic formula used by some of the wealthiest individuals in the world to ensure and protect their wealth. I think you should do it too. The reason you should use JM Bullion is because, well, number one, I can talk to the president anytime I want to. So if you have a hiccup or concern or something like that, I can take care of it for you. Two, they have better pricing than Monex and Atmex, which are two of the leading sellers in the industry. And three, they have really cool stuff. If you need any more reasons than that, maybe you're not ready to buy silver and gold yet. Anyway, check them out today, jambullion.com. But I do have another reason. If you're buying $300 or more in gold or silver, they'll give you a discount as a member of the Sport Brigade. So there's one more. Next up today, Western Botanicals. Right now, I am so grateful that Western Botanicals is somebody that I'm aware of and I know of. I'm using their anti-inflammatory medication and their deep heat ointment on my shoulder on a daily basis right now. I had a shoulder injury that occurred when I was 18 years old in the United States Army on a jump, an airborne jump, where I dislocated and damaged my shoulder seriously. And in spite of prodding and attempts by the government to get me to do surgery to it, I decided that at that age it was really stupid to cut my arm open and do all kinds of weird stuff to it that I would then have problems with the rest of my life. And in general, this shoulder injury causes me very little discomfort. There's certain things that I need to not do with my shoulder, and if I don't do them, and it's just certain weird ways and angles that I've learned over the years trigger like a recurrence of this injury. And then working really hard or, you know, doing systema demonstrations and hitting pads, sometimes I can re-agitate this injury. I did that at the recent workshop, and my shoulder has made me pay for it for like 2 weeks now, and to the point of being annoying to where you're just like, I need this to stop because I can't think. That type of thing. And, you know, I can take Advil or Tylenol or something like that. It doesn't really do much to help me out. But when I use the anti-inflammatory formula that's mostly turmeric and some other things from Western Botanicals and put this ointment on it, I'm able to deal with it and give my body time to heal itself. That's just one example of how I actually use Western Botanical products in my life. I suggest you check them out. If it's legal and herbal, they have it. It's all either organically grown or wild-crafted. And if you're a member of the Support Brigade, they give you their discount membership for the first year for free and recurring years at half price. The discount membership's $50, so that 1 year of free discount membership at Western Botanicals pays for your entire first year of the member support brigade, and then some right now because it's a sale. More on that in a second. But it gives you 25% off everything they sell. And if you use their products, that membership pays for itself, and it really pays for itself when it's dun-dun-dun free. Okay, now next up on the MSB. I've got a great MSB discount vendor of the day for you today, somebody I haven't talked about in a while. Next Level Training. These are the guys that make the CIRT, and that is S-I-R-T, which is a tool to train with. It shoots a laser from a, in my case, I have a Glock 17 scaled, but they make them in different models and makes, so they work and function exactly like a real firearm. They weigh the same dimensions, same controls. Magazine drop, the whole nine yards. And when you fire them, they project a very accurate laser. They even make one that fits into the bolt of your AR to train with your stock AR. So with your AR that you actually use or these mock-up handguns. These allow you to do realistic training, force-on-force training, and what they really do is help you develop muscle memory. I don't know about you, but I can't shoot all the time. I can't just go out and shoot every time I want to, especially now that I don't live like I did in Arkansas or Pennsylvania where I had the back door to go out and shoot. But because I have a CIRT sitting in my living room, literally every day I'm picking that up and picking different points on the wall and firing shots and getting real-time feedback. This is a great tool. It's not cheap, but it's because it is a good tool. It's not some cheap kid's knockoff thing, you know, like a little laser tag gun or something like that. This is a realistic, a lot of thought, a lot of engineering went into making this thing accurate. Well, if you're a member of my support brigade, you can buy those for 20.5% off. So basically, I got you guys the law enforcement discount that Next Level Training gives on the certs. So what the department, the police department for Dallas pays for these is what you pay for them individually. That's one of the many benefits of the MSB. On that, MSB is on sale until the 20th. MSB is on sale till the 20th. $30 for your first year. Discount code is SPRING14, S-P-R-I-N-G, the number's 1-4. And that means what you normally pay $50 for, you get for $30. That means that your discount membership is profitable pretty much on day one. You can learn more by clicking on members on the website. Again, the price is $30 versus $50 for everybody. Discount code SPRING14. Yes, you can use it paying by mail. Just write it on the form and fill out things appropriately thereafter. With that, let's get into the main topic of today's show. And the episode is 1333. There we have repeating numbers again, 333. That adds up to 9, by the way. And with a 1, it adds up to 10. A whole number. Kind of cool. Anyway. 1333. The Chapel Bridge in Lucerne. Lucerne recently joined the Confederacy along with several other cantons. In time, the Confederacy will be known as Switzerland. But for now, the most interesting thing about Lucerne is a wooden footbridge they have built across the Reuss River. It still exists in the modern day. It is the oldest surviving wooden-covered bridge in Europe and the oldest truss bridge anywhere. It includes a water tower, which still exists but no longer is used as a water tower. Apparently, they made things to last in Switzerland. It's called the Chapel Bridge because of the chapel nearby. My take by Alex Shrugged, who puts these together for us, I was amazed that a wooden bridge that old still existed. I'd like to hire the engineer that built that one. It was almost destroyed by fire in 1993, but was restored in 1994 at a cost of $2.2 million. Given all the 14th and 16th century paintings of the trusses, on the trusses, it was like restoring a masterpiece. My take is just plain wow. To think that we could, as human beings, build something from wood in 1333 that would stand the test of time and still be not just existing, but serviceable and usable in 2014, pretty amazing. When you have to think about how much we're squandering by not trying to build things with that type of lasting reliability in the modern age and how vulnerable that makes us. Not just how vulnerable it makes us so you'll prepare, but how vulnerable it makes us that doesn't have to be. We need to think about building lasting things in our lives. That's why I talk about permaculture a lot, building permanent culture into your life. Anyway, with that, let's get into Conflicted Monday. This is where I read you one of the cards from the Conflicted card deck, and you guys come tell me in the comments on the blog what you would do in the Conflicted scenario. generally we take these scenarios as the end of the world has happened, dogs and cats are having puppy kittens, the zombies have risen, the world is, we know it has ended. Today's scenario will be a little bit different than that, because we're going to talk about it from before and after collapse. But before we do, I'd like to revisit last week. Last week, the basic synopsis was, you have to choose between two people and you can only pick one. One's a 20-something with a strong back, but no real skills, and the other's a 70-year-old woman, and she's enfeebled. She basically needs help to just walk, but she has an incredible diverse knowledge of how to live off-grid. She knows how to do things. Can't do them, but can tell you how to do them so you can do them. And there was a lot of feedback, and a lot of people, and I would say the majority, sided with taking the 70-year-old woman for the knowledge. And only a few said to take the young person with a strong back. When I look at that one, I have to answer it with, of course, it depends. Here's my purely analytical way of looking at this from the standpoint of thinking it like a business person. In business, you hire to your weaknesses. You do not hire to your strengths. Meaning, if you're an insane creative nut job like me, you don't hire someone to work for you, at least if, unless you've got the organization rounded out now and there's a space. But if you're hiring someone to work directly with you, and that's going to be one person that works directly under you and the only person working directly under you for the foreseeable future, you do not hire a crazy nut job creative type into that position. The reason you don't is the two of you will spend hours and hours talking about all the things it could be and very little time scheduling and getting the things done because you don't have the organizational skill set. You'll have way too many ideas and way too little practical application of the ideas. So you hire the more mild-mannered, time-centric scheduler, doer, logic thinker into that mix. And if you are that person, then you need to go out and find the eccentric, crazy thinker and rein in that creativity with logic and scheduling, right? So you hire to your weakness. So the way I would make that decision is, if I have a group with extensive knowledge, but we're older people and we're lacking on physical attributes, I'm taking the young guy, because I can take our knowledge and put it in his head. If we're a bunch of young folks with a lot of energy and strength that can compensate for the weaknesses of this older person, and we need the knowledge she has, would take her. Now, the actual answer is I would prefer to have both. I prefer to have both. But in conflicted, I don't get that choice. Now, here's the other thing I have to look at. It depends. How old and enfeebled is this person? If she's going to be dead in 2 weeks, all right, and I have to make a choice, her or the guy, she's going to be dead in 2 weeks, how much knowledge can we really get out of her in 2 weeks while she's dying? I know that sounds harsh, but this is a conflicted scenario, right? If she's going to be around for 2, 3, 4, or 5 more years, and we can basically turn her into our college of skills, then, man, I want that. The weakness on the strong back. One injury away from being enfeebled and doesn't have the knowledge. That's why if you make me choose, I'm going to go with the older person unless there's an accentuating circumstance, right? But The young man with the strong back can fall down one cliff and be just as enfeebled as that old lady, just as physically inept as that old lady, and not offer knowledge and skills. Whereas the old lady, the only thing she can do to weaken her position with us is become comatose or die. Anyway, today's conflicted scenario. This is a cool one. The survival group you belong to has lots of children. What are the 3 essential life skills that every child should know in today's current society, not at the end of the world, right now, based on things being the way they are? What are 3 essential life skills you would want to make sure the children in your group had? Now, what are 3 other skills you would add to their education in a post-apocalyptic world after a collapse? Now, notice, other skills. So you can't say, well, these 3 skills should be taught regardless. You have to come up with 6 skills, 3 for today and 3 that you would add on after the collapse. All right, with that, we have finished up on Conflicted Mondays, and I want to just give you a quick announcement about PermaEthos and where we're going with that. We've heard back from our partners in West Virginia. They've done a lot of work to get housing ready for our tenant farmers and Josiah. We have one potential element partner we're evaluating right now to install a business unit this year. Seeing if we can work out the logistics with that. We're now taking applications. We need another tenant farmer. So we need somebody that wants to live there for a year, 2 years minimum. Okay? 1 year minimum, 2 years ideal, with the understanding that you're being trained and developed to run your own farm eventually, perhaps even this one, depending on whether Josiah and Jesse want to go elsewhere or stay on this farm. Okay, so Jesse Techmeyer and Josiah Wallingford have already been selected, so we're taking applications for another full-time tenant farmer. We're also taking applications now for Wolfers, which is willing workers on permaculture farms, kind of a twist on woofers. These are people that will come up for a couple weeks or more, and we provide you a place to stay, and we provide you basic food. That doesn't mean we cook for you. That means, like, here's your food, prepare it for your group, okay? And these are people that are going to work about 4 hours a day minimum, and then with the other time, you can work, you can learn, you can reflect, you can, I don't know, take a walk in the creek, whatever you want to do. But 4 hours a day of work, you're not paid for this. This is a, like woofing. This is, you get a place to stay and some food in your belly and you get to learn. Our hope is that those people will become the third thing we're already taking applications for, element partners. Element partners are going to be people that come to the farm and set up a business model. And then we take a small piece of it and you keep the lion's share of the profit, but we're not paying you. You're developing a profitable business and it either is profitable or it is not. So we have those positions available for application now. I'll have a link in today's show notes where you can go over to the Permit Ethos blog and apply for those. Next big news. We will probably have, by the end of next week, everything set up, and we may be able to start taking reservations for the Permit Ethos PDC. It's going to be a very unique PDC. I'll probably put out a video explaining more about it later this week, but we will not be taking money this week. We have some things to get done so that the money is going into Permit Ethos Inc., not Jack Spirko Inc., because they need to not co-mingle monies. That's why we can't do it yet. Yes, MSB members, you will get first crack at being one of 1,000 foundational partners in Perma Ethos. So we're going to have 1,000 people take the Perma PDC at a discounted rate over what we're going to sell at retail after we reopen it. And all of this is going to be done in the field. All of this is going to be Josiah teaching the field, myself and Nick Ferguson answering your after unit questions. There'll be testing, quizzes, and a full PDC certification. PDC certification and a level 1 certification from Perma Ethos. More on that to come in the future. So those of you that are interested in being part of the Perma Ethos movement, this is the way we have for you to do that now. And I'm really depending on you guys, honestly, to be part of this. A lot of what we're going to do is dependent on getting enough people to take a bet on us, make the investment, buy the education, buy the positioning, and then letting us take that revenue and put it to use on the farm. This is one of the biggest things I've ever done in my life. It's certainly the biggest thing that we've all collectively done together with the Survival Podcast, and I want to prove that it's possible to develop systems that make money for people, take care of people, provide quality life for the animals in those systems, right up to the point that they graduate into delicious steaks and other delicious items, and can diversely shepherd an ecosystem. And yes, we can feed ourselves and we can feed our communities without toxic pollution. We don't need to spray the shit out of the world to feed the world. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and get into your first actual feedback. I know I went kind of long with that today, but man, we got a lot going on. And again, I need you guys, that 1,000 member foundational membership, that's going to be key to getting Perma Ethos established. And it looks like the price of the PDC is going to be about $300. And we may even work on some ways that we can have you guys do that in an installment plan or something like that to increase the number of people that participate in that. And once we hit that 1,000, it's over. And I've already been asked, can I buy one for myself and my wife? The answer is absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go ahead and get into your first bit of feedback today. Here's a question I can honestly say I've never received before. Jack, are there any reasons I should or shouldn't keep a tarantula around my garden? I was reaching to an underground irrigation control valve for my garden. A little voice said I should check before reaching to turn on the valve. Although most of the time I don't, sitting on the valve was a healthy-sized tarantula. Other than scaring the crap out of me, my gut tells me it's otherwise harmless and will do more to help control pests than hurt beneficial insects or me. Your thoughts? After taking a few pictures and showing it to the kids, I left it in peace. Hope that was the right choice. And this is from Greg, who seems to be in Texas. There is no real harm that can come to you from a tarantula in the United States anyway. There's no highly venomous, you know, kill you, put you in the infirmary, other than if you had an allergic reaction, which you could have to a bee sting or an ant bite, honestly. So there's no reason to fear the tarantula. They do have a pretty good set of chompers on them, and it's not comfortable to be bit. But they don't want to bite, and they're generally pretty big on kind of threatening with raising up and pointing their ass out, because they have still hairs on their ass, and if those get into your skin, they're really itchy as hell. So they'll do both of those things. Now, I actually ran into a tarantula, a pretty big one, a brown tarantula in Arkansas that I filmed. I'll put a link to the video in today's show notes where you can see it, where I kind of get out of the truck and play around with him, and he goes running off. Actually, she, because she's large enough. But here's generally what I found with tarantulas. I haven't had any here yet. We did have a great big female living near our garden in Arkansas. She made a hole in the ground, and she kind of acted like one of those crabs at the beach with a hole. She'd be at that hole, but if you came near her, man, she'd go down that hole. So she's shy. She doesn't want to be bothered. As she's a generalist predator, the tarantula. They don't like specifically target the type of pests that are bad for your garden or the beneficials either. They pretty much eat whatever they can get that's big enough to support the size that they currently are. You'll also find that you'll probably see tarantulas quite a bit in spring, like now, and in fall. This is when they're moving to their wintering over or summering over locations, and you probably won't see that spider much. I mean, if she was in the valve thing, she'd go down in there, but it's not really her natural habitat. They like much more to have a true burrow where when they're in there, they feel secure. So she's probably not going to live in there. She's probably moving around, found that spot, and set up camp. If you ever find a hole that's mostly round in your garden and there's not moles or something like that around, it's probably a tarantula. And the males are half the size maybe of the females. That doesn't mean a small one is a male, because it might be a female growing, but a large one, comparatively speaking, is a female. The males just never get up to full size. I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't bother with her. I would always, when you're putting your hand into a dark, cold place, check the area, wear gloves, etc. Now, tarantula probably can get through all but a thick, heavy, super heavy-duty pair of gloves, but other spiders that can't would include things like black widows and brown recluse. I have a lot more concern about being bit by a widow than I do about a tarantula, and I am not really like hyper alert for widows, but I do pay attention just because of the number of them we have around here. So, you know, it could be a snake, it could be a sharp piece of glass down in there that you didn't know was there. That whenever you go into a dark, unknown area, there's always something that could be there that could physically do you harm. And there may not be, but it's always possible. A sharp piece of rusty metal, right? I would much rather be bitten by a tarantula, as much as I don't want to be, than to really gouge the shit out of my hand, especially in a grid down scenario with a sharp piece of rusty metal. There's a lot more potential for infection and sepsis and things like that from that nasty piece of metal than probably being bit by a spider. So just use some caution. Teach your kids not to mess with it. And watch this video and you'll see that this spider wants nothing to do with me, though she does get a little bit threatening when I kind of antagonize her a little bit to get that behavior out of her. But otherwise, they just want to be left alone. We had that one that lived in that burrow. I think a good 3 or 4 months that spider was there, and every night we'd walk, we'd see her legs sticking out of that hole, and as soon as she got near and she felt your vibrations, boom, back down the hole. So we were more than happy to have her there, and a large tarantula will take out things like small mice, which is also a good thing. Let's go ahead and take another call, and again, thanks for that question. Again, that's one I've never had before. All right, here's another question I don't think I've ever had before. This comes from Dustin. Dustin says, how do I find the point on a hillside that's several hundred feet from my house and level with the roof line? Background info, my house is on a hillside. I want to put my rainwater cistern as far up the hillside as possible while still gravity feeding from my gutter outlet. I was thinking about a string with a string level or maybe some type of water level with a garden hose. I'm sure there's a fancy laser level, but I'm also sure you know of a cheap and easy way to do this. Thanks, Jack. This is from Dustin Powers. All right, here's the deal. to get the water from the roof to the place on the hillside, you're going to have to use pipe. So check it out. Set your pipe up. You're going to use anyway. You're going to have to buy the pipe if you're going to do this. Now, I'm going to give you another way if you just want to evaluate whether you should do it or not in a second. But if all you want to do, so you buy some pipe and you start laying your pipe and create head pressure for yourself. Get yourself a small tank. Set it up at the roof level, top of a ladder or something like that. It's probably not a bad idea to have a small pressure tank to move this volume of water anyway, instead of just letting from the gutters do it. So having it flow to a pressure tank that's almost at roof level on a little tower, and that pressure tank then feed the water into the cistern in the distance is probably a better way to do it. As you extend your pipe, I know you don't know how much pipe you're going to need, but you can estimate. Take a garden hose, fill up your pressure tank. When water comes out of the pipe, you're still good. When you get to the point where the pipe, you put add another elevator onto the pipe, and water stops coming out, you're above the level. Back it down, put your tank there. I mean, the reason I say that is the simplest method, because pipe's cheap and you have to buy it anyway. And you're actually doing, so you know, I'm assuming you know, like, I want the tank on that hillside. Not like you have three different hillsides, you're not sure which one you're going to do. If that's the case, what I'm going to tell you next would be a better method. But if you kind of know, I like it, kind of want over there, and I'm not sure if it's there or there or there, the pipe itself will give you the answer when you hook it up to a pressure tank and fill up with a garden hose. Simple. That's the simplest method I know. You could also get an eye level. Johnson makes these. They're a little bitty level. They sell for about $20-25. I'll put a link to where you can get one on Amazon today. They're a good idea to have anyway. I use them on walkarounds all the time. And what you do is you stand and you look at a point in the distance and you look through this little level. It's like a little scope. It's about 6 inches long, made out of plastic. And there's a bubble in it. And there's a dead center line. And you move it up and down until you find where that level is. And when you look out into the distance, you're seeing a spot on the ground. And if you just stay, then that spot is level with your eyeball. Okay? So now, you just pan over to another place and get it level again, and those two points are level with each other. Now, you would have to fine-tune this in the end, but I give you a very quick approximation of two level spots. So, a way that you could do this is back off in one direction, going upgrade until you're at a point where you can look through that level at your roof line. Then look over to the hill that you want to put that on, put the cistern on, and wherever that bubble is level on that hill, mark something on that hill, and that's pretty much level with your roof line. Now you actually want to be the entrance point of the cistern. You really want to be somewhat lower than the roof line to give yourself enough flow for time for the water to get over there with enough pressure to fill the cistern. So that's another way that you could do it. Another way that you could do it really, really quick, if you have a bunch of garden hoses, a couple hundred feet of garden hose laying around, again, set up some sort of pressure tank. It could even be temporary. All right, so what I'm talking about by temporary is, again, a small waste can with a hose bib tapped into the bottom of it, sitting on top of a ladder. Fill it up with water, attach a hose to it, put your hose all the way out, go until you till you think you're about right, open the hose bib, see if water comes out the end of the hose. Lower the hose down the hill until water starts coming out of the hose. You now know you can get a water flow through there. Then you can mark that, and then you can eval. So if you already have hoses, any way you can hook up a hose to a tank and then just, you know, run it. But if you're going to go a couple hundred feet, well, you know, you have to have a couple hundred feet of hose. Now, if you're going to need the hose anyway and you buy it, fine. But so those are my three simple, low-cost ways to do this. The right way to survey it would be with a dumpy level or a laser level. And since I have a laser level, that's what I would do. But if you don't have a laser level, all of these methods work. The other thing, though, is do you really need to do this? Would you be better suited to just raise the tank up a couple feet and use the base pressure and the volumetric pressure to move water around? If you're going to move water long distances, your method is far superior. If you're going to basically water stuff around the house, unless the house is in a real low point, probably works anyway, to just put it on a platform near the building itself. But again, maybe not. You know, maybe not. The other option that you would have, and two is one, one is none, is to place a tank adjacent to the house, put a small solar pump in there that pumps water over to there, but that's going to probably be inefficient and probably not what I would really do thinking about it. You can move water quite a ways with a small solar pump. Use a very you're moving a very small amount of water all day long while the sun's up. And that actually is really not that great an idea for this application because you have gravity to work in your favor here, but it's a good thing to know for other people that might be trying to consider how to move water over greater distances. The other thing is make sure you size your cistern appropriately. You know, don't go putting in a 10,000-gallon tank if the roof that you're shedding can only be counted on to get you 10,000 gallons a year. Because if you're using it at all, it will never fill up, and you're overspending on the tank. And if it's a bigger tank, the top's higher, right? So the bottom's lower. Let me say that again. If the top of the tank's higher, the bottom's lower, so the pressure that you're able to gain is less. So if you have a tank that's 10 feet tall versus a tank that's 5 feet tall, the bottom of your tank can be 5 feet higher and still get the water in the top of the tank. So don't oversize your tanks in comparison to the roof collection ability of your building and the water usage patterns that you'll have. Now, if you have lots of rain for half the year, and you can fill up a 10,000-gallon tank during that time, and then almost no rain through another part of the year when you'd be heavily using that water, going very big makes sense. But use, you know, a calculator to determine how much water on your roof you're going to get a year based on average rainfall, how much watershed, and what your usage is to size your tanks. And in your application, though it would cost more for the tanks, I'd rather have two shorter tanks than one tall tank. Because again, I want to get as much pressure off of that hillside as I can. In most instances, you'll have to make the final determinations for yourself, but that's how I would figure out approximately where to place my tanks. Let's take another email. Well, before I go on, though, I looked up that tool so I could post it for you in today's show notes. Johnson Level and Tool 80-5556 Contractor Handheld Sight Level is the product I'm talking about it. And I said that they're about $20, and they list at $21.90. They're on Amazon Prime right now for $12.99, which means if you have a Prime account, free shipping. So if you've been thinking about picking one of these little guys up, especially if you're a Prime member, it might be worth. I'm going to probably pick up a couple just to have extras around for training and whatnot today myself. Here's an interesting thing. Ryan sent me this. A couple other people sent me this one. Michigan's legislature voted and passed a resolution calling for a constitutional convention. They are the 34th state to do so, meaning two-thirds of the number has been reached. Does this mean anything for those who miss America? And it's on politicalears.com. There's one thing that really tips me off to this baby not being the greatest place in the world to get your information, this politicalears.com. As I look at this, it's marketing. This is top secret. Top secret. It's top secret that Michigan did this, and that's not good. And then there's an advertisement for a credit card knife, which is fine. But then as I go down, right in the middle of the article, there are 37 things you need in case of crisis, like a natural or man-made disaster. Click here to find out what they are. And as I keep going down, I can get coupons for Betty Crocker. And as I keep going down, get the Liberty Amendments here. Be educated, which is another ad for a scam artist. And then one travel looking for thrill seekers. And then click here for an emergency message for all American patriots. And this is all tied into those ass clowns with the 37 things to hoard, which I have a pretty low opinion of the entire operation. So, it's already clear that this publication is designed to sell based on fear and what have you and paranoia to the preparedness industry. So I'm already a little bit concerned. The beginning of this does talk about someone who's done some pretty good work, especially if you are more of a conservative mindset, less so if you are someone like me who's more of a libertarian anarcho mindset, but Mark Levin and his book, The Liberty Amendment. So you may be aware of Mark Levin's book, The Liberty Amendments, released last year, which called for a convention of the states. Article 5 of the Constitution gives several states the ability to convene a convention in which the Constitution may be amended, changed, or even scrapped. Last week, Michigan's legislature voted and passed a resolution calling for a constitutional convention. They're the 34th state to do so, and this should trigger a convention of the states. Pretty major, yet MSM is ignoring it. Read on. Okay, and then it goes on to this whole thing. All right, let me tell you why MSM is ignoring it, because probably nothing is going to happen, because many of these movements for a constitutional convention occurred in the 1970s around things like the ERA. Many were more recent in the 90s, and they were specific around things like balanced budget amendment, and only for the purpose of balanced budget amendment. So it really kind of sort of doesn't all go together, right? It wasn't the individual states simply calling for a constitutional convention with everything on the table. Okay, so that's part of why MSN is ignoring it, is because, well, it's not really that newsworthy. Probably nothing's going to happen. Now, one of the congressmen, I don't remember who it was Paul Ryan or somebody, wrote a letter to Boehner asking him for clarification on whether or not the requirement had been met. Here's the technicality. Here's the technicality on why maybe it should happen technically. The Constitution gives the states the authority to call for a constitutional convention. It does not specifically give them the authority to call for it only based on issues like the ERA or balanced budget. Just simply the authority to do so. Once they've done so, they have in fact done so. It gives them no authority to rescind the call. So it doesn't give, like, let's say South Carolina puts out a call for a constitutional convention and then says, yeah, we don't really want to do that now. It doesn't really give them the ability to rescind, but it does not so this is one of those technical Supreme Court issues that could be in cases for years. It doesn't say they can, but it also does not say that they can't. The Constitution does not say that South Carolina cannot rescind its request for convention. Now, I think the reason it doesn't give them the power to is what it doesn't want to happen is, so all the states call for a constitutional convention like in a normal period of time, like a year or two. And all of a sudden, like, South Carolina gets wind that it's in the minority on some things it wants done, and now it wants to bail out and not go to convention. So it's probably the I'm guessing here, probably the intent of the framers of the country that you don't have that ability for one state to just pull out because they're going to lose after they asked for it, okay? And a lot of the crap that goes on today, I don't think they really foresaw some of the crap that we do today with you know, government in general. Like, if the framers of the Constitution, the founders of the nation were here today, they'd ask the average person, why aren't you shooting by now? I really think that many of them, I know Jefferson would. Jefferson would be like, what are you people doing? Why are you allowing this to happen? I think not really one of the founders of our country, but one of our early presidents, Andrew Jackson, if they brought him back, would go, you did what with the banking system? After all this shit I went through, you did what? So we're in a different world on some levels. Like, things are happening now that have not happened before. When there was calls for constitutional conventions in the past, it was generally yay or nay, like either the states all did it or they didn't. It's been so long since we've had one now that there's all these legacy calls. Again, the 70s, one big thing was ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, and several states were on board with that. So is it technically that the requirement's been met and the convention must be called? And I think it's very hard to force that on the states. In other words, if you want a convention, you have to have 34 states right now willing to do it, willing to say, we're still in, we want this done. And even if technically you're supposed to, I don't think it can be accomplished. I think if you have, you know, multiple states who have rescinded their calls, told now we're going to do it, if they say, yeah, we're let's go, baby, and there's at least 34 that are like, let's have this out, then yeah. Because even if they say, well, it doesn't count anymore, okay, fine, we've reissued it, here you go. I think if we have 34 states calling for it now, it happens. It's constitutional. This way that it kind of got pieced together over 40 years, no, I don't see it working. I don't see it happening. Now, let's talk about whether it's a good idea or not. Everybody thinks that if something like this happens, that the stuff they want would be the stuff that would get done. Well, what about that pesky Second Amendment? You know? Are there enough states that would amend the Constitution to weaken the Second Amendment if we had all 50 at the convention? Because remember, it's not just the 34 that called for it that show up. So California shows up whether they like the idea or not. And how many of these states that are supposedly pro-Second Amendment are still for quote-unquote common sense gun control? How do we know that we would not increase the power of government, whether at the state or the federal level, if we had another constitutional convention? Now, could the states get together and tell the federal government, we've passed a balanced budget amendment. You will not spend money we don't have. Yeah? Do you think they're going to? What benefit is it to the states who are the recipients of federal wealth distribution to do so? In majority. Remember, we need a two-thirds majority of the states voting for an amendment to send it to Congress and the president. Two-thirds. So, that would indicate that you need at least two-thirds of the states who are on the end that's being taken from versus the end that's being received to. And the reality is that we've made sure in our society as a whole that that's not the case. That the majority are on the take and the minority are on the taken from. And that's true at the state level, that's true at the federal level, that's true at the federal level back to the states, and that's true at the voting level. Entities don't tend to vote against things that benefit them. So, if you make a list of all the states that get more back from the Fed than they pay in, there's a larger number of states. And it's not like Congress where you get so many representatives based on your population. Every state counts in the Constitutional Convention as a single vote, and we need a two-thirds majority of the states to amend the Constitution. So, I'm telling you, as much as I hate to admit it, I think it's far more likely that we would end up with an amendment reducing the freedoms as seen under the Second Amendment than we would with an amendment that would strengthen our economic position in the world. I believe that the only thing a constitutional convention would result in at this time would be greater and more powerful government. And if you really want to look at it this way, and if you go back and examine them, and I might not have my numbers exactly correct here, but I believe it works out this way. The first 10 amendments restricted government, period. They gave government no additional powers. They were all restrictions on the power of government. Okay? Of all the amendments since, there has been one that reduced the power of government by repealing a previous amendment, which was prohibition. I believe there were two that gave additional rights to people, specifically segments of people, and all of the rest of the amendments since then have bestowed greater power upon the government. So our founders restricted government, and almost everything done afterwards increased the power of government and reduced the freedom and liberty of individuals. Yes. We had amendments that recognized women's right to vote and recognized racial equality. Okay? Take those, put them on the shelf, and know that they existed because government inhibited those things in the first place. Okay? Now, then take the repeal of prohibition, which was obviously a greater liberty to people. You can now drink. Okay? And realize the only reason that amendment was necessary is a prior amendment that restricted people and empowered government. Put that on the shelf. And everything else afterwards. Bigger and more government. So do you really want this? Do you really want to buck the law of averages that much? And do you think that the state politicians of today are more or less liberty-oriented than the state politicians of, oh, I don't know, 1913? And do you really think this is a good idea? I personally don't. I'd like it to be a good idea. I would very much like the states to assert their sovereignty, call a convention, and assert restrictions upon the federal government, period. Not greater power for themselves, more restrictions on the federal government, on federal spending, on federal authority, on federal supremacy. I'd like to see them strip the federal government to the bone and say these are all things that we do individually as sovereign states within a federal republic. And that way, if you don't like it the way we have it in California, move. If you don't like it the way we have it in Florida, go to California. I'd very much like that. I do not believe that the nation and the people running our governments at all levels, local, state, federal, all of them, I don't think any of them are truly for decreasing the size and scope of government at meaningful enough numbers to make it worth the risk of having somebody jack around with an already damaged and, frankly, currently disdained constitution. I believe our government actually hates our constitution. I really do. I believe our government, and I mean the states as well, not just the United States federal government, but the state governments in many cases hate the Constitution. I believe that a lot of the people in law enforcement, especially top-level administrative law enforcement people, hate the Constitution because it restricts them. And I think the only motivation of those in power is to reduce restriction, not to increase it. It took a very special group of people in the founding of this nation to go, well, here's a document that sets up our government. And then to look at it and go, man, we didn't restrict ourselves enough. Let's write 10 more amendments to this thing that restrict us further. And I ask you, when in the course of history of this nation anyway, has our government willingly restricted its authority on such a level ever since? And why do you think they would do so now? What's different now? I say what's different is they want more power than ever before. All right, next up, I want to talk a little bit about the NSA. I got an email here from a listener about the NSA admitting wrongdoing. It's on Reason.com, and I want to read part of that to you. But before I do, I want to play for you a segment on a show called The Lip.TV about NSA Director Keith Alexander admitting to lying. Admitting to the NSA lying, in this case, not about whether or not they're listening, but about how successful it was. And then I want to go and read to you this article that was sent to me, and I want to talk about how much bullshit we're really dealing with right now with people spying on the American people and how unconstitutional that really is. So let's go ahead and hear this segment again. This is from the Lip TV. I'll put a link in the show notes to the full video on YouTube if you want to take a look at this segment rather than just hear it.
On Wednesday, October 19th, during a meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee, NSA Director Keith Alexander became yet another government official to admit a crime against the citizens of the United States and just forget to lie about it. Committee Chairman Senator Patrick Leahy stated that, quote, "There is no evidence that bulk phone records collections helped to thwart dozens or even several terrorist plots." Leahy then asked the NSA chief to admit that only 13 out of the previously claimed 54 cases of foiled plots were genuinely the fruits of the government's vast dragnet surveillance system, going on to say, quote, "They weren't all plots and they weren't all foiled. Would you agree with that? Yes or no?" "Yes," replied Mr. Alexander.
We reported this story back over the summer when it kind of happened, and I remember we had talked about how, you know, 1 minute when the NSA corruption and spying story first broke, they were, you know, getting up in front of Congress saying, well, we thwarted 20 attacks, then it was 30, then it was 50, maybe even 100, and he was one of the kind of main liars behind this.
Right.
And what's interesting to note is that now, you know, there's rumors on Capitol Hill that he's all upset because he's being hung out to dry because of things like this.
Yeah.
And why isn't Obama protecting me? Sorry, you lied to the American people about the NSA surveillance program and then tried to, you know, gussy it up saying like, oh, look at what a good job we're doing. You know, bullshit on you, Mr. Alexander. And quite frankly, you know, you're a despicable human being because, again, that's that culture of lies. You see it in a microcosm of Detroit, and now you see it up here at the highest level.
Yeah.
You know, the officials basically put out numbers that vastly overstated the counterterrorism successes of the government's warrantless wiretapping. And I mean, they, you know, just spread it out there, you know, heavy.
And you have,
every news show carried that.
And you have people like Mr. Leahy and Representative James Sensenbrenner Jr., a Wisconsin Republican, an author of the U.S. Patriot Act, which the government says allows this bulk data collection, and they're working on a bill to roll back that authority. So people who actually wrote this bill are now going, I think we might have made a mistake. They're also proposing things like a special advocacy office with appellate powers to be part of the proceedings of the secret FISA courts that we've talked about a lot on here, and requiring the court to release those secret opinions that lay out interpretations of the law, which is something we've talked about. You can't have secret courts that are interpreting the law and then not let people actually see that interpretation of the law. It goes back to the idea that you're telling us something's illegal and we're responsible to not break a law and not do something, but you won't tell us what those laws are or what's going on.
Because at the end of the day, the NSA is there to spy on everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, I actually got a little bit of good news about the NSA is that their big, huge Colorado facility, or Denver facility, we've heard about, that they're building this massive thing. Apparently they finished it, tried to boot it up, and like everything like burned out. So now they're another year away from being able to use it, which is, you know, a little bit good news for us fighting on the side of, you know, of transparency. They're not quite there yet, thank God.
Right.
It's interesting to hear, the other liar. James R. Clapper, he was quoted as saying, you know, in response to all this, in response to Alexander saying, yes, we did make it up, he came out and said, well, I think there's another metric here that's very important. I would call it the peace of mind metric. So though we inflated the numbers, we just were trying to give you a good peace of mind, you know, in our lives. We just want to make sure you're feeling okay.
Well, thanks.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, James.
All right, with what you just heard in mind, and you got a little bit about Clapper there at the end, and we're just trying to give you some peace of mind. Here's the article to follow up this on Reason.com. NSA admits to wrongdoing, what now? Listen to this crap. Last week, the director of National Intelligence, James R. Clapper, sent a brief letter to Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat, Oregon, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, in which he admitted that agents of the National Security Agency have been reading innocent Americans' emails and text messages and listening to digital recordings of their telephone conversations that have been stored in NSA computers without warrants obtained pursuant to the Constitution. That the NSA is doing this is not newsworthy. Edward Snowden has told the world of this during the past 10 months. What is newsworthy is that the NSA has admitted this. Those admissions have far-reaching consequences. Since the Snowden revelations first came to light last June, the NSA has steadfastly denied them. Clapper has denied them. The recently retired head of the NSA, General Keith Alexander, has denied them. Even President Obama has stated repeatedly words to the effect that, quote, no one is reading your emails or listening to your phone calls, end quote. The official NSA line on this has been that Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA court, has issued general warrants for huge amounts of metadata only. But content metadata consists of identifying markers of emails, text messages, and telephone calls. These markers usually identify the computer from which the email or text was sent or received, and the time and date of the transmission, as well as the location of each computer. Telephone metadata is similar. It consists of telephone numbers used by the callers, the time, date, and duration of the call, location of each telephone call used in the call. American telecommunications and internet service providers have given this information to the NSA, pursuant to warrants issued by secret FISA court judges. These warrants are profoundly unconstitutional as they constitute general warrants. General warrants are not obtained by presenting probable cause of a crime to judges and identifying the person from whom the data is to be seized, as the Constitution requires. Rather, general warrants authorize the government agent to obtain whatever he wants from whomever he wants. These general warrants came through a surreptitious route of presidential, congressional, and judicial infidelity to the Constitution during the last 35 years. The standard that the government must meet to obtain a warrant from a FISA court judge repeatedly has been lessened from the Constitution requirement of probable cause of a crime to probable cause of being a foreign agent. So first you had to have a crime. Then FISA came along and said, well, if you might be a foreign agent, we'll issue a warrant, a general warrant, at least, so we can look into it and see if we need a more, you know, specific warrant. Then to the probable cause of being a foreign person. Well, if you might not be from here, well, maybe we need to look at you. To the probable cause of talking to a foreign person. Well, you spoke to a guy named Jose, so maybe we need to look at you. From this last category, it was a short jump for the NSA lawyers to persuade the FISA court judges that they should sign general warrants for all communications of everyone in America because the NSA was not accessing the content of these communications. It was merely storing metadata and then using algorithms to determine who was talking to whom. So you can read the rest of the article if you want to. Basically, the case made to FISA was, look, there's terrorists out there. Ahmed the Dead Terrorist and all those other guys, they're going to try to kill us. And if we can analyze all this data, we don't have to look at what Joe said to Tom at all, ever, unless we come back and ask for an additional warrant. All we're going to do is say, hey, this guy here is calling Iran like 15 times a week for 2 minutes at a time, and he's doing it to like five different numbers. But all those five numbers keep repeating, and something's not right here, so maybe we need to look at this guy, and then we'll give you a case for why, and then you can give us a specific warrant to go in and actually, you know, start listening to all this stuff. Because now we have probable cause. Something's not right. Ignore the fact that we got the information unconstitutionally. And as bad as that was, at least there was some restriction on it. And what the NSA has been saying ever since Snowden came out and said, bullshit, it's not what they're doing, is we're not doing that. We're only going in and listening and reading after probable cause has been established and new warrants are obtained. This general warrant is just to collect the data and use algorithms to point to places where there might be a concern. Oh, and by the way, we've stopped like 20 terrorist plots because of this. 30! Like it was like 50, man. It was like, there were like 50 plots. They would have killed like thousands of Americans. That's not true, is it? Well, yes, it is. That's not true, is it? No. Okay. And then this thing about not reading our emails, not listening to our phone calls, not prying into, you know, in us, to not actually reading and listening to the conversations of innocent Americans. That was a lie too, wasn't it? No, it's not a lie. That was a lie too, wasn't it? No. No, that Snowden guy, you can't trust him. He's crazy. He hates America. No. Okay, but you lied when you said that, didn't you? No, but you lied when you said that, didn't you? Yeah, we lied. But don't worry. It was to give you a good feeling. You want a constitutional convention with this government? And I know what some of you are going to say. If not that, then what? In some instances, I agree. But we're not ready yet. This type of thing can only occur in a nation of cowardly sheep. We are a nation of cowardly sheep. And I know some of you are mad at me right now. Don't be. I'm not saying you're a cowardly sheep. I'm saying if we just go out and randomly select 1,000 people off the street, you got about 900 of them that are cowardly sheep. Ill-informed, lazy, full of bullshit propaganda and bullshit pop culture. They can probably tell you the size of Kim Kardashian's ass, but they can't tell you the procedure by which to amend the Constitution of the United States. Such people do not stand in the face of tyranny, they kneel. And if you try to fix the problem with a nation of sheep, they will sell you out to the wolves. They do not like you because you are the sheepdog. The sheepdog looks like the wolf, but lives with the sheep, so he scares the sheep. The sheep would rather make a deal with the wolf. Sell out the sheepdog. Sell out their brothers and sisters for a promise to not be slaughtered until they're fat, happy, and ready to go. What's the society you live in today? This crap cannot happen in a nation of sheepdogs. As much as I dislike government in and of itself, as much as I feel that if we give power to anyone, they will abuse it, under our system of government, if our people had a freaking spine, if our people believed in themselves, if our people were as self-sufficient as our marketing campaign would indicate, this government would be dismantled in a nanosecond, in just the next election cycle. Tom, the local fireman, would be going to Congress. And he wouldn't show up and meet a fat cat with a party dues bill, because that guy would be gone too. There wouldn't be a single person sent back to the Hill in the Congress in one election cycle. There'd be none. One third of the Senate would be turned over fully and completely in one election cycle. You'd have a guy for president that had never served as a professional politician in the first presidential election after this. We would take the country back. The platform would be the dismantling of all of these apparatuses of government, and the nation would return to what it was at one time, which wasn't perfect, but a hell of a lot better than what we have now. Within 6 years of the minute that this nation went from 90% cowards to 90% emboldened, there wouldn't be a single politician who was in office the day that it happened. Not one. Every single governor would be out of office, every single state representative, every single state senator, and you can't make a case for retaining any of them if you want to fix this problem. They must be excised. They must be removed and sent to live in the mess that they created. You've done enough. We're done. We're going to do this ourselves. And anybody that got elected that said, I think we need a new law that says, would be out. Because we'd go, you know what? We have enough of that now. It's time to start pulling it away. Anybody that says, I think we need a new tax, or we need to increase a tax, or we need to increase a fee. We need to do something about this problem that doesn't involve getting the hell out of the way, would be gone. Because people who are fearless do not want someone else to fix their problem for them. And if they do, they want a specialist. In other words, if a guy wrote a book about cars, but that's all he'd ever done is write a book about cars, and your car was broken, and it was in such a condition that you were beyond your skills to fix it, you wouldn't take it to the guy that wrote the book. He's a politician. He'll tell you all the reasons your car broke in the first place and why it shouldn't have been built that way. No, you would take your car to a specialist, a mechanic who specializes in your type of problem, and you would say, fix the car. And he would fix the car. And the only time that you're going to ask someone to do something to fix your problem, two things are going to be the case. One, you're going to go to somebody with the proven ability to fix the problem. And two, you're going to expect that they are to be compensated for what they have done. You are never going to go to somebody who's never fixed the problem before and will only fix your problem by stealing from somebody else and giving you something as a handout. Not if you're an emboldened, empowered person. If you're a cowardly sheep, that's a good deal. Our nation is where it is not because of those in charge. Our nation is where it is because we've allowed them to be in charge for so long, so incompetently, and so maliciously. Your emails and are being read, your text messages are being read, and your phone calls are being listened to because the majority of the people sending emails and making phone calls are cowards who refuse to stand in the face of their government and demand better. And what's the solution? For now, live your life emboldened because no one else is going to. You're outnumbered 9-1 right now, folks. I don't care if they call themselves Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, Independents. I know some of you are going, but Jack, aren't you the guy that said there's no point to voting? Yep, and I just made the case again. I've just made the case again. There is no point in me voting for someone who is going to advance government, but advance in a different way than the other guy. I have no choices right now. There's nobody for me to vote for. There are only people for me to like less. I am 10% of the whole, and the 90% are the ones that are giving me my two or three choices in each instance. And what I'm saying by not voting for those is no to all of them. You give me something to vote for, and I'll do it. You give me the ability to vote for the repeal of a law. Not the replacement, the repeal. It is no longer there, it no longer applies. I will do so. You give me the ability to vote for the repeal of a tax, I will do so. You give me the ability to vote for the repeal of a position in government, I will do so. You give me the choice between a traitor and another traitor, and I will give my endorsement to neither. Let's look at it this way. For those of you that really struggle with this, this is how I feel about this. I hate Monsanto. I know you think it doesn't apply. It does. Hold on. I hate Monsanto. I think they are one of the worst companies in the world. I think they are one of the most evil corporations in the world. I think they have done massive harm to our nation and to the world now for almost 100 years. In everything from PCBs to modern day genetically modified organisms and spraying our food with toxins and indeed engineering our food so that they can spray toxins on it that would otherwise not be able to do so. From patenting seed strains that are ancient seed strains in foreign countries because nobody had gotten around to patenting them yet and taking them from an open source to a patented model, to developing life forms and placing a patent on. I can't think of a corporation that I have greater loathing for than Monsanto. I can think of many companies that I would put on the same level of loathing, but greater, I can't think of one. They are the devil incarnate as far as I'm concerned. If I look at Conagra, I could say a lot of things about Conagra that I just said about Monsanto. But I can build you a much greater case for how bad Monsanto is and how Conagra's bad, but they're not so bad. So me, in the last presidential election, to have voted for our only hope, Mitt Romney, versus Barack Obama, would have been like me saying, you know what, I'm not going to run a Monsanto banner on the Survival podcast and endorse them, but I'll endorse Conagra because they're the lesser of two evils. That thinking is why this crap is going on in your country right now. Well, we can't have Satan be president, so let's make one of his demons president. At least it's not as bad. He doesn't have as much ability to destroy things as Satan does. This is the mentality used to choose a president of the supposed greatest country on earth. We are a nation of sheep and cowards. Don't be one. And you're probably not, or you would have not listened to this show at all, let alone today's version of it. I doubt that anyone who listens to this show is truly a coward. I doubt it. Seriously doubt it. I doubt you are a sheep. Seriously doubt it. I do think, though, that even those with strength and fortitude, even those with self-determination, can look at their world and feel, well, I don't agree with this, but I've got to make the best of what I have, and on some levels, I've got to pick a side. You do have to pick a side. Pick your own side. Pick the side of your family and your community, and pick the side of right. Collaborating with one mafia family, because the other mafia family is worse, leads to nothing but sorrow and misery. Look at Afghanistan. Our supposed enemy of today was our ally of the 1980s, because we believe that the enemy of our enemy was our friend. And all that's brought in that country is death and destruction. And all it's brought in us is hatred. There is no more time for siding with lesser wrongs. Side with what's right. As you see it. And I don't fear saying that. Even though I know some of you would say, well, this is right. And I would say, well, that's right. What I know collectively as individual, sovereign human beings is that our version of right is better than any version of lesser wrong. And it takes courage to believe that. It takes courage to trust your fellow man that stepping outside is the only way to be. That individuals should choose how they live their lives, how they educate their children, how they feed their families. And so long as they're not stealing from somebody else or harming somebody else, they should be left to themselves. That is what made this nation what it once was. And it is the only thing that can restore it to what it can be. And it's the only thing that can ever one day fulfill the promise of what it was supposed to be. Because, folks, you can listen to all the star-spangled banners you want. You can watch all the fireworks explode you want. You can watch Truth March. You can watch all of this crap. You can feel good. You can rah, rah, rah. You can believe it in your heart and soul. This nation has never fulfilled its promise. This nation has never fulfilled its promise. And that is not the tragedy. That is not the tragedy. The promise of this nation was so great, so beyond what anybody had ever heard, that it was understood that it could not instantly fulfill its promise, that it would have to be given liberty to the extent that its promise would manifest itself in time. The tragedy is not that we have not fulfilled our promise. It's that we've stopped trying to fulfill our promise. That's the truth. The good news is you don't have to stop trying. And every time one of us stands up and says, I will build what's right for me and my family and my community. I will not endorse cowards. I will not endorse criminals. I will not endorse thieves. I will stand on the side of right. Solely because it's right. And solely because I'm called to do so. Because I value myself as a human being. We get a little closer. And it might be 90-10. But we don't need even a majority to switch the balance. All we need are enough emboldened individuals to wake up the vast majority. Because don't hate the 90%. You were probably one of them at one time. We now have a society where people are born into that mentality, conditioned into that mentality, brainwashed into that mentality, have that mentality constantly reinforced, and they're told there's something wrong with them when they question it. Don't hate them. Pity them, and since they're sheep, until they're ready to walk for themselves, lead them. Because inside all of them, well, most of them, is the potential to do right for right's sake and to have courage. It just has to be demonstrated. I mean, if you want more proof that your government's out of control, that they're now doing things that no truly free people would ever allow to occur, how about this? Also from Reason.com. Uncle Sam revives feudal practice to collect from children of debtors. I'm not making this up. Holding children responsible for the debt incurred by their parents is a feature of historical feudalism with a modern third world and modern third world shitholes. I can't believe it actually says that, but it does. Developing countries, by and large, assume the debt dies with the person who willingly incurred it, or at least stops with his or her estate. By and large, I write, because the U.S. government has broken with centuries of tradition holding individual responsible for their choices, opting to withhold tax refunds from children whose parents incurred vague and often ill-documented obligations to the feds. writes March Fisher of the Washington Post. A few weeks ago, with no notice, the U.S. government intercepted Mary Grice's tax refunds from both the IRS and the state of Maryland. Grice had no idea that Uncle Sam had seized her money until some days later when she got a letter saying that her refund had gone to satisfy an old debt to the government, a very old debt. When Grice was four, back in 1960, her father died, leaving her mother with five children to raise. Until the kids turned 18, Sadie Grice got survivor benefits from Social Security to help feed and clothe them. Now, Social Security claims it overpaid someone in the Grice's family. It's not sure who. In 1977, after 37 years of silence, 4 years after Sadie Grice died, the government is coming after her daughter. Why the feds chose to take Mary's money rather than her surviving siblings is a mystery. Across the nation, hundreds of thousands of taxpayers who are expecting refunds this month are instead getting letters like this one Grice got, informing them that because of the debt they never knew about, they're often a debt incurred by their parents, the government has confiscated their check. The new multi-generational debt collection practice required a two-step policy change. One was the elimination of the 10-year statute of limitations on debts to the federal government. The other involves the Social Security Administration insisting that if tiny tots indirectly benefited from public assistance collected by adults decades ago, those now grown ex-tots are responsible for any overpayments the feds may claim. The elimination of the statute of limitations may on its face allow the government to go after individuals responsible for incurring debt, but the longer time horizon means accurate records can be hard to come by. According to Fisher, Social Security officials told Grice they had no records explaining the debt. How do you collect a debt you can't prove exists through the sheer grinding weight of the state of course? Going after the next generation, which never made the decision to incur a debt to begin with, really is a massive break from previous policy. Okay, so you can read the rest of the article if you want to, but just the Jack Spirko non-bullshit explanation. You, for some reason or other, were raised by a parent who received some form of government assistance from Social Security. The government gave that money to your parents who did whatever they did with it. You may or may not have directly benefited from it. At some point, at any time in history, they decide now that they overpaid. They shouldn't have given your mom that much money. So, they say, we want the money back, but your mom is dead. And they say, well, we'll take it from you. And you say, well, how much do I owe? We don't know. How much did you overpay? We don't know. Who exactly got the money? Was it my mom or was it another member of my family? We don't know. But we're taking your money. Nation of cowards. A nation of cowards. There should be about 10 million people standing with this lady right now outside the IRS building demanding an explanation. Outside the Social Security office demanding an explanation. Where's this woman's money? Where is it? It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Because if it doesn't affect the temperature of the water in my pool, I really don't care. That's the average American. That's how the average American feels right now. It's only when they do this to enough people that either we're going to make the swing back toward liberty or the final plunge into total tyranny. Only when you feel the noose around your neck do you begin to fight with the hangman. And most people, they've got the noose around their neck. Their feet have been weighted down. The only thing left is to kick the support out from underneath them. And they not only don't know it, they've helped the hangman apply the noose. And they've willingly attached the weight to their feet. That's the nation we're living in today. When a government in modern times can do this to a person. And the most telling statement in this article, the one that really identifies the problem, is how do you collect a debt that you can't prove exists through the sheer grinding weight of the state, of course. This power should not exist. The power to take from someone against their will, their property, rightfully incurred, should not exist. There should be no tax on income and property in a country that's enlightened, because both are theft. Do you want to put up fees that are voluntary? If you want to tax commerce, so that the person buying the item decides I'm going to buy this item and pay the fee or not? I'm not really enthralled with sales tax, but it makes more sense. It's not directly against what I own, and I'm choosing to enter into commerce, which triggers it. But then, to take it another step and go, well, we stole from someone else, and we gave to your mom, but we gave her too much of what we stole, so now we're going to steal it back from you, and everybody's supposed to be okay with this? This tells you the reality. The economic endgame is happening right now. It's probably not going to happen tomorrow morning. Don't run out and freak out. But we're getting to a point now when a government starts behaving this way, it's saying we're out of money and we have to figure out how to get more because we're out. They're saying we're reaching the end of the ability to just create money and steal money by our accepted theft protocols. And we're now have to invent new theft protocols to steal new money to keep the system running. This is what Argentina did. This is what the Soviet Union did. These are the same tactics. Fernando Aguirre, when I had him on, he said they started doing things in Argentina like this. Oh, you just bought three new things for a lot of money. Therefore, you must have money. Therefore, we're going to tax you because you spent money. Not a sales tax. Like, we're just going to ask for more money because clearly you have it. Or you wouldn't have bought this TV and this car. This is the same thing. Now, when I first read this, being the astute individual I am, my bullshit detector initially went off. I was like, I bet this is how this worked. I bet what they're saying is that the parent owed money to the government, and then the parent died and left money to the child, and the IRS jumped in the front of the line and said, no, they owe that to us, you get what's left. And they're saying that it's this other thing. That's what I figured they were, that it was some kind of yellow journalism. I'm skeptical about something like this. And then you research it, you find out that it's true. Because even for our thieves, this is unprecedented stealing. And not only to do it, but when you say, well, how much do I owe? And they don't say, we're not going to tell you. They actually say, we don't know. Well, who did you overpay? We don't know. Why me and not all of us? We don't know. But shut up and we got your money. Now you notice the thing is, the reason they can do this is that they have the authority to just take the money. They just have the authority to take the money. Now what would I advise this lady to do? Man, max out your withholding, baby. Remember I just did a show where somebody asked, is it better to have them owe you money in a refund or owe them money in at the end of the year? If I were this lady, I'd be shooting for them to be as close to zero as possible. Or to owe them. You owe them a grand. Here's your grand of the taxes I owe you. We'd like some more, please. F off. They were able to seize the money because they already had it. They didn't have to prove that it was due to them. They just had to not give it back. And the federal government used federal supremacy to seize the money the state of Maryland already had. Those of you active in local politics, well, this would be a great one. This would be a great state sovereignty thing. This would bring, you know, if you want to be political, there's a good one. How about suggesting that your state pass a resolution that says the federal government can't claim state tax returns to pay off the debts of a parent. Boy, if you can't get bipartisan for support for that, get the hell out of your state. Maryland, you might not be able to do it. Why did they target her? Maybe because it's Maryland. Maybe because she had a return. Maybe the reason her siblings didn't get targeted is they owed money or they had very little to no return. Maybe they targeted her because the money was there. Maybe in the words of criminal John Dillinger, who at least had the courage to admit that he was a criminal, they robbed the bank because that's where the money was. Maybe they went to her because she had it. That's most likely. Occam's razor, which we learned about recently in a history segment. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. She probably had the money. It was theirs, and they could, so they took it. What kind of nation do we live in? Who wants to tell me how we are blessed beyond all other peoples of the world with American exceptionalism? When we live in a nation where the head spy agency lies to the American people, admits they lied to the American people, violates the Constitution, and nothing happens. And that a guy that tells the truth has to run away from his country, hide in a country that's supposed to be our enemy, continue to tell the truth under threat of not just imprisonment but execution. You want to make the case? Explain that. Explain the case where a woman is held responsible for a debt that not only did her parent not likely really incur, but never knew they were incurring. No wrongdoing was committed. No fraud. It's just like, oh, we overpaid you. So we're taking it back. Our once great society is falling and falling fast. It's up to us to start the rebuilding before the collapse, folks. That's why I do this show with optimism. Because sooner or later, this laborious beast must collapse under its own weight. And all I'm suggesting is that you build your future now and get out of its way and let it fall. Because it can't continue. No nation can begin to aggress against its citizenry at this level of wrongdoing and endure for time. Our nation will either be saved by its people who will wake up, or it will be fall and be put back together by those that were able to stand through the fall. Those are the only two choices we have at this point. We cannot continue on this path and endure. It is not possible. Every time a nation has turned this far from what is right and decent and oppressed its citizenry to this level, it has fallen. It has become weak and vulnerable, and internal strife has squashed it from existence. That's where we stand. That's where we stand. And I, for one, would rather stand at this time than any other. I'd rather be here for this than not be here for this. I'd rather have it said one day that I was part of the people that either did save this country or put it back together or at least tried to save it than to have been one of the, quote, lucky ones who just lived in it when it was okay. It's an exciting time to be around. True patriotism, folks, is not loving your flag or loving your nation in spite of all that it does wrong. True patriotism is believing in the ideals of freedom and liberty, and believing that your nation, no matter where it is on the spectrum today, is worthy of it and fighting for and working for it. That's patriotism. Blind allegiance does not equal patriotism. Submission to power and authority does not equal patriotism. Sacrifice in it and of itself does not equal patriotism. Patriotism can either be the last refuge of a scoundrel, in the words of Mark Twain, when it simply uses an excuse, or one of the greatest virtues a human can have when it's practiced purely. You can be patriotic in a totalitarian state, and the way you do so is by opposing the tyrants. And I want to finish today with something that gives me hope. When people in the system that benefit from the system begin to willingly walk away from the system, which up till now has fed them at the expense of others, and on their way out the door, tell people the truth and go out and figure out how to live their life in a new way and no longer be parasitic and no longer be part of the problem and be honest that they were part of the problem, that gives me hope. Because that's how the beast will die, if it dies. Enough people to just simply say, I'm not participating any longer. I'm not going to be part of this anymore. This is called My Resignation Letter. It is real. It is by Pauline Hawkins. I have vetted it as being factual. Dear Administrator, Superintendents et al., this is my official resignation letter from my English teaching position. I'm sad to be leaving a place that has meant so much to me. This was my first teaching job. For 11 years, I taught in these classrooms. I walked these halls, and I befriended colleagues, students, and parents alike. This school became part of my family, and I will be forever connected to this community for that reason. I am grateful for having had the opportunity to serve my community as a teacher. I met the most incredible people here. I am forever changed by my brilliant and compassionate colleagues and the incredible students I've had the pleasure of teaching. I know I've made a difference in the lives of my students, just as they have irrevocably changed mine. Teaching is the most rewarding job I have ever had. That is why I'm sad to leave the profession that I love. Even though I am primarily leaving to be closer to my family, if my family were in Colorado, I would not be able to continue teaching here. As a newly single mom, I cannot live in this community on the salary I make as a teacher. With the effects of the pay freeze still lingering and Colorado having one of the lowest yearly teaching salaries in the nation, it has become financially impossible for me to teach in this state. Along with the salary issue, ethically, I can no longer work in an educational system that is spiraling downwards while it purports to improve the education of our children. I began my career just as No Child Left Behind was gaining momentum. The difference between my students then and now is unmistakable. Regardless of the grades or test scores, my students from 5 to 11 years ago still had a sense of pride in whom they were and a self-confidence in whom they would become someday. Sadly, that type of student is rare now. Every year, I have seen a decline in student morale. Every year, I have more and more wondered about students sitting in my classroom, more and more students participating in self-harm and bullying. These children are lost and in pain. It is no coincidence that the students I now have coincide with the No Child Left Behind movement 12 years ago. It is only getting worse, and with new legislation around Race to the Top, I have sweet, incredible, intelligent students sitting in my classroom who are giving up on their lives already. They feel they only have failure in their futures because they've been told they aren't good enough simply by a standardized test. They've been told they can't be successful because they aren't jumping through the right hoops on their educational paths. I've spent so much time trying to reverse those thoughts, trying to help them see that education is not punitive. Education is the only way they can improve their lives. But the truth is the current educational system is punishing them for their inadequacies, rather than helping them discover their unique talents. Our educational system is failing our children because it is not meeting their needs. I can no longer be part of a system that continues to do the exact opposite of what I am supposed to do as a teacher. I am supposed to help them think for themselves, help them find solutions to problems, help them become productive members of society. Instead, the emphasis on Common Core standards and high-stakes testing is creating a teach-to-the-test mentality for our teachers and stress and anxiety for our students. Students have increasingly become hesitant to think for themselves because they have been programmed to believe there is only one right answer that may or may not have been given yet. This is what school has become, a place where teachers must give students right answers so students can prove on tests riddled with problems, by the way, the teachers have taught students what the standards have deemed our proper education. As unique as my personal situation might be, I know I am not the only teacher feeling this way. Instead of weeding out the bad teachers, this evaluation system will continue to frustrate the teachers who are doing everything they can to ensure their students are graduating with skills necessary to become civic-minded individuals. We feel defeated and helpless. If we speak out, we are reprimanded for not being team players. If we do as we are told, we are supporting a broken system. Since I've worked here, we have always asked the question of every situation, is this good for the kids? My answer to this new legislation is no, this is absolutely not good for the kids. I cannot stand by and watch this happen to our precious children, our future. The irony is I cannot fight for their rights while I'm working in the system. Therefore, I will not apply for another teaching job anywhere in the country while our government continues to ruin public education. Instead, I will do my best to advocate for change. I will continue to fight for our children's rights and a free and proper education because their very lives depend on it. My final plea as a district employee is the principals and superintendent ask themselves the same questions I have asked myself. Is this good for the kids? Is the state money being spent wisely to keep and attract good teachers? Can the district do a better job of advocating for our children and become leaders in the education system rather than followers? I'm going to answer that before I finish this letter. No, they can't. No, they can't. Public education system is broken to the point where your superintendent and your principals cannot fix the problem. They cannot do it. It is not possible. Anyway, I'll read the rest of the letter now. With my resignation, I hope to inspire change in the district I have come to love. As Benjamin Franklin once said, all mankind is divided into three classes. Those that are immovable, those that are movable, and those that move. I want to be someone who moves and makes things happen. Which one do you want to be? Sincerely, Pauline Hawkins. Well, there's some baggage in there that being a teacher for that many years will create, but overall, I agree totally with the tone here. And it does give me hope. And what Ms. Hawkins should do is create her own educational program, the way Jen Mendez is doing, and offer it to people for a fee. And see if anybody actually wants to learn the way that she wants to teach. And she might find that there's a couple thousand students do. And she might be able to do that on the internet. And she might be able to make more money doing that than she ever was making as a conventional so-called teacher. And she might find that she can do more good that way than by being an advocate for a change in a system that cannot change. Asking the public education system of today to change is like asking water to not be wet. It's like asking water to be dry. It's simply not possible. If you examine the structure of the public education system, starting off with federal mandates, the fact that those even exist immediately destroy the true local influence over the schools. Local influence over the schools have become more restrictions on students, more manipulation of the educational paradigm, more control over the curriculum. So, the only thing that local authorities are able to do now in schools is more of what the Fed is already doing. They can make it worse, but they can't make it better. Because the federal government takes monies out of their states and says, now you need this to run your schools, and they make damn sure that it costs that much to run a school with federal regulations, and they say the only way you can get it back is to do what we say. So again, you're asking water to be dry. It's not possible. You have to get rid of the water. So the first thing you have to do to get any control over the public education system in your state is eliminate federal involvement 100%. The federal government should have no say over how Florida educates its children. Period. What about inequality? That's about inequality, not about education. Right? So if you're discriminating against somebody, by the way, we've kind of gotten past that now in this nation. We don't need to constantly dig up what happened around the Civil War up to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and the tail end of it in the 1980s that I experienced for myself. Like, we've kind of gotten past that. Right? But if it does happen, that's a discrimination issue. In a federal republic, that's their place, but just exactly what book is used, or what testing is used, or what grading criteria is. It's not the federal government's business. So until that happens, there is nothing to be done with the public education system. Unless a state can stand up and tell the federal government to their face, take your money, shove it up your ass, we're doing things our own way. You'll either give it to us, and we'll do what we want with it, since it's our money anyway that you took in the first place, or we will do without it and sue your ass while we're doing our own thing. But we just don't want you anymore. Out. And if federal authorities come in and try to enforce it, that state needs to put them in jail. That's the only way you can even start. And it's still screwed because the state systems are just as bad. There is no fixing the current public education system, which is why it will fall on its ass. Which is why half of the people employed as teachers in this country within 10 years will not have a job. Not in public education. You'll either have a job doing something that's not teacher related. You'll either be teaching for a private institution. You'll either be an independent contractor. You'll be doing your own thing in the educational paradigm. Or you'll be part of a cooperative educational program that's designed to teach people outside of government's influence. At least half will be one of, or unemployed. That's it. Because you don't, you're not going to need as many teachers as we have when you have so many students no longer part of the educational system. This is what I was talking about when I talked about the whole, you know, evolution versus creationism and getting into that debate inside public education. It doesn't matter. Because this is the real problem. This is what this teacher is telling you. Listen to these words. They are the most important words about what is really wrong with our educational system. Every year I have seen a decline in student morale. Every year I have more and more wounded students sitting in my classroom, more and more students participating in self-harm and bullying. These children are lost and in pain. Gun regulations that put guns in the hands of teachers won't fix that, for those on the right. And gun regulations that make private citizens' ability to own a constitutionally protected right of having a firearm will not prevent that. And no one wants to talk about it that way because that's not easy. We can't pass a law to fix these children are lost and in pain. I have a good friend, and I didn't understand when he told me why his son killed himself, how that could be, and I do think I do now. At 20, this young man hung himself in his bedroom. And in digging through all his things, they finally found basically a suicide letter that was part of a journal. He didn't just leave it out there. He wrote it, he put it away, and later he acted on it. And the only thing they could derive from it is this young man killed himself because he could see no future in which he would be anything that mattered, anything that would be a success. And I know some of you are thinking, hey, having standards and requirements and stop doing this crap where we have a cap and gown graduation from pre-K. This is what we need in our students. You're only answering half the problem. This self-loathing is being caused by all this supposed things to make kids feel good about themselves. When you make people feel good about themselves for doing nothing extraordinary, constantly, eventually they figure it out and they just feel worthless. And then when you create a test that is so specific that it requires the teacher to spend half their time teaching that test to students, and this isn't new. This was played with in Jacksonville, Florida, when I was there in junior high with something called the MLST, the Minimum Level Skills Test. There were 48 questions on the test in history. I got all 48 correct. Because I have a really good memory, and the teacher had seen the test before it was given. But I didn't learn shit. I didn't learn anything by answering those questions on that test. I learned history from reading about history, studying history, discussing history, delving into history. You want to know why you have a nation of cowards? Because this is just the evolution of an ongoing degrading of an education system that was flawed the day it was created. This educational system was created in the 1880s. It's based on a Prussian model. It's designed to make workers who show up, shut up, and do what they're told, and don't think for themselves. And to create such a restrictive environment that only the truly exceptional will just rise to the top like cream, and then you take them and you call them gifted and you put them in their own little classes away from everybody else, and all you do is advance them quicker. But you keep them in the same controls. And then you put them into better institutions of higher learning, and you put them in charge of the people they excelled when compared to. And this is 2014, and your kid has a cell phone with more computing power than the computers used in the 60s to put men on the moon. And we're still using that outdated, archaic system, and yet we've actually made it worse. We've actually made it worse. Because now we have stupid rules. My sister-in-law has a teacher. Said, I'm up till 11 o'clock at night grading papers and tests. Why are you doing this? She's like, well, somebody has to do it. I'm like, when I was in school, we had all our desks in rows, and when you got done with your test, you passed it behind you, and the kid in the back row got up out of his seat, went up to the front row, and put it down, and then everybody graded it. They went back through the test with us. And unless it was an essay question or a report, if it was just yes, no, true, false, multiple choice, fill in the blank, definitions, right? every teacher would just go and say, number one, the answer was blah. And they might talk, you might actually learn through this process. And then everybody would get a grade. And then you'd get your test back. And if you disagreed with how the other student marked it, there was only very rare occasions on this, you'd ask the teacher, hey, I think that I should have got this right. They'd look at it and go, you know what? You should have got that right. Or no, you were wrong. This is why. And everybody'd pass the test in. And then the teacher didn't have to go home and spend hours grading 30 test papers. It was all done in like 10 minutes. And you learned by doing it. And she went, oh, we can't do that. What? What do you mean you can't do that? She said, oh, they don't let us do that because if the child gets a bad grade and the other child sees it, they might feel bad about themselves. See, in an effort to protect people from pain, you create massive pain. In an effort to make people feel like they've achieved when they have not, you create a sensation of achieving nothing even when they've achieved something. By rewarding mediocrity, we have devalued exceptionalism. What about the children that aren't exceptional? You weak, if you're asking that question, I'm going to say this and I know I'm going to piss you off. You weak-minded fool. You weak-minded individual. To say, what about the non-exceptional children? We are all exceptional beings. We all have gifts. We all have talents. They're just not all the same. If we teach children to learn, if we teach children to educate themselves, if we teach children to empower themselves, if we teach children how to develop their own questions and find their own answers, where they are exceptional will be easy to identify. What about the non-exceptional children? What about the non-gifted children? You weak-minded individual that would say that about any person. Even the mentally challenged and the physically challenged have ways in which they excel, ways in which we learn from them. The biggest problem with our education system, students never teach. Students never teach in our modern system. Students are put in place, told to shut up, listen, and learn, to memorize, to recite, and to be indoctrinated. I have to say that even when I was in school, it was encouraged, not during a test, but during assignments, that we discussed them with each other, that we talked to each other about them, that we teach each other. If a student said something that questioned the book but made sense, the teacher would say, and not like targeting them, like, stand up, Johnny. Tell everybody what you think about that. And then even if they disagree with it, they wouldn't say like, well, you're stupid for believing that. They would be like, well, this is why we get that. But that's awesome that you dug into that and found that. I think you should look deeper into it. Maybe you should consider that for your thesis this year. That's not patting somebody on the head for graduating pre-K. That's not putting a kindergartner in a cap and a gown. That's identifying individual learned behavior. That's identifying individual research. That's identifying independent thinking and acknowledging it. And gee, what happens is everybody in class goes, gee, maybe I should think for myself too. We can fix the educational system in America. But we cannot fix the public education system in America. It's not going to happen. Advocating for it won't do anything. Stop advocating to fix that which is broken and make it obsolete. If you really care about education in America, create a new pathway for education in America. Just do it. Don't ask for permission. Don't ask for permission. Just do it. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this.
tidy up their cares. They're living for today. Revolution is you.